you ready to awaken to a new you? Welcome to Healthy You Radio, the radio network that empowers you to heal you. Dr. Keisha Yours is here to share over 30 years of frontline medical experience, bringing you the latest scientific and medical research tempered with the holistic wisdom of Ayurveda and functional medicine, all so you can be the best you can be. And now your host, Dr. Keisha Yours.
Welcome to Healthy You Radio, everybody. This is Dr. Keisha Yours, your wellness coach and advisor, and bringing you radio that empowers you to heal yourself. And good afternoon, Eric.
Hey, good afternoon, Keisha. How are you today?
I am great. Beautiful, sunny summer Seattle day. Can't get better than this, right?
Absolutely. It's not even officially summer yet, is it? But it sure feels like it.
I know. Our thermometer says it is.
That's right.
It's really nice. Which I'm glad, because we are actually talking about a really serious subject today, and it is, it sounds sort of weird for me to say I'm excited to talk about it, but I'm excited to talk about it. We have certain subjects in our culture that are taboo, and I always say we don't talk enough about sex, and we don't talk enough about death, and we're going to be taking on...
You definitely get excited about the taboo subjects.
I do, and it's just because there's so much misinformation, and it makes people suffer as a result. And so I just really get excited about making certain topics of conversation, tabletop conversation. So today we're going to tackle one of those. Our guest today is Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell. She's a psychotherapist with 30-plus years of experience, and she's the director of outpatient treatment at Liberation Clinic, which is a substance abuse clinic in Stamford, Connecticut. She's also the founder and director of the Green Heart Center, which is a holistic psychotherapeutic and psychoeducational center in Stamford. She's the author of Making Peace with Suicide, a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. Welcome to the show, Dr. McDowell.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ewers. I am thrilled to be with you and have this important conversation.
You know, I had to stop myself when I said I'm excited to talk about it because, you know, that sounds sort of silly to put together, excited to talk about suicide, but I have seen over my years, you know, I've also been in medicine 30-plus years, and I've seen so much suffering from this, from the repercussions of it, from a, like I said, there's a misunderstanding and misinformation, and I just am so happy to have you on the show today to talk about this and to really maybe dispel some myths and give some information that people can use, because I don't think any of us have not been touched by this in some way with some degree of, a degree of acquaintances, friends, family, right?
Oh, absolutely. It is 6 degrees of separation. We all know somebody or know somebody who knows somebody. Mm-hmm. And equally, many of us have held the thought, even just as an abstract thought, in our hand for a nanosecond, too. It's not so foreign, even though it has been horribly taboo, and that taboo historically goes back to, you know, the way the church would look at it. They'd take away your property, and they'd seize this, and you couldn't be buried here, there, and whatever. We have some parts of the world where if you attempt suicide, you will face imprisonment. There's a lot of taboo and guilt around this whole topic. And I think it's a choice we make on one level. You can make a choice for living and dying, of course, but you also make a choice on how you live, right? Are we living what I would call soulful lives? We have a TV commercial and a radio commercial here on the East Coast for Dunkin' Donuts, and the guy's tagline is, "Time to make the donuts." So if we feel like our life is always time to make the donuts and we're not being filled, then I would even say that that is a kind of half-dead life that we're leading that we need to switch up as well. It's hurry, hurry, rush, rush. There's no time for anything.
Right. I hate to tag in on the Dunkin' Donuts thing. I ran the Boston Marathon years ago, and I was astonished. There are as many Dunkin' Donuts on every street corner in Massachusetts as there are Starbucks here in Seattle.
That is really true. They are everywhere.
They are everywhere.
Suicide is everywhere. Starbucks is everywhere, and Dunkin' Donuts are everywhere.
So suicide really does reach to every area of the planet. And as you were mentioning, churches will, you know, in the old days, take away your property. But there's also currently, you know, modern day, a lot of churches believe that if someone commits suicide, then they don't go to heaven. Right?
That's right. Some people are a little more involved. I interviewed one gentleman while I was writing the book, and he had lost his dad when he had come home from school. He lived in the Boston area, as a matter of fact. He got something to eat, and then, you know, it was snowing. He was a good kid, and he went down to the basement because he was going to take care of the snow, and he found his dad. And as he was talking, I said, "Your dad had profound mental illness, didn't he?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "From the sound of your name, it sounds like you might be Irish Catholic. Would that be true?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Tell me how, was the funeral okay?" How did he said, "The priest was wonderful. And he talked about mental illness and that this was an illness." And so it gave them comfort. But another woman I spoke to in Canada told me that people were coming up to her in her small town in Canada saying, "You're not having the funeral in the church, are you?" And you've got that whole thing where people are very, very judgmental around the topic of suicide.
Right.
And they judge. There's one woman in the book, I think the story is called 2 Weeks Before Christmas, and she tells the story of she comes home from work and her daughter is outside. She goes, "Honey, what are you doing?" And she goes, "Her brother said to go outside." And she said, "Well, you wait here." And so she's going to go find out what goes on. And unfortunately, you know what I'm going to say. And she finds that her son has taken his life. And she said, when her daughter went back to school, and now this was a good 20 years ago, so we have evolved some, but the teachers didn't know what to say to her. Her classmates didn't know what to say to her. And the best thing they could do was move, you know, they moved and they changed schools so their daughter could have a fresh start. It's for survivors of suicidal loss, meaning loved ones who've lost someone to suicide. Suicide, we call it complicated grief, right? And as you well know, one door of grief opens up another. But it's also traumatic, either what you've seen or where your mind has taken you, right? Mm-hmm. And one door of trauma leads to another door of trauma. So it's a very deeply painful and a very rocky road to walk in coming back after losing someone to suicide.
So there are certain risk factors for suicide. You know, I was at a conference last weekend that was dealing with genetics and neurotransmitters and how our brains work, you know, in relationship to epigenetic factors, you could call them, which are the lifestyle choices that we make that help us either turn a gene on that serves us or turn one off that doesn't serve us really well. And so a lot of the things that I've noticed that are risk factors are your lifestyle habits, but you're also talking about some cultural risk factors that are affecting us as a society and as a people. And why don't you talk a little bit about those?
You're absolutely right, Keisha. For example, we can look at economic issues. It's been written in the paper about foreclosures and debt collection and bankruptcy and even young people getting out of college or graduate school so engulfed in student loans. You know, and if we go to the genetic things, we have the family history, right? If there's mental illness or suicide, substance abuse or violence, those kinds of things, right? And we've got, of course, again, genetically speaking, mental health issues. We've got those. But we've also got physical issues, organic brain disease. We're finding now with the combat soldiers who return home or professional athletes as well as school athletes that if they have a lot of traumatic brain injury, which, as you know, is cumulative, right, that soft tissue damage is cumulative, it can lead to something called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And, you know, that leads to a depression. I think it was Dave Duerson who played with some team. I mentioned it in the book, and I can't bring it up now. But he took his life, and he did so by shooting himself in the heart. And he left a note that said something to the effect, "Please, please, please take my brain to Boston University to a particular clinic where they were doing studies, and they found lesions in his brain as a result of his head being, you know, slammed back and forth in the helmet and within his skull that led to this. So we have that, you know. We have always the psychological issues, which, of course, we know about. And there's the social issues. I mean, people who are isolated, people who are incarcerated, copycat suicides are huge. And then we have the trauma. The other is bullying. Or I have never worked with anybody who wasn't a childhood sexual abuse survivor who has not seriously considered and or attempted suicide. And I also did a lot of volunteer, and I've done work with Disaster Action Mental Health, and I've done work like Katrina and Joplin and through other organizations, Newtown and 9/11, right? And when people, when there's an accumulation of stressors, right, sometimes the last one is just way too much, and suicide becomes an option because the thinking has become small, and the neurochemistry could be haywire, and it's a choice that people make.
You know, you've mentioned a couple things in here that I want to unpack, but I'll tell you that when I found out about my own sexual abuse and was trying to unpack it, I definitely could feel that it just felt so overwhelming. I didn't really want to go on. And so I called a counselor to get in, and that I had been referred to when I was trying to get on a healing path. And when she heard me say that I was really struggling, I didn't have a plan, I didn't really want to commit suicide, but I was really waking up in the morning not wanting to live, she said, "Well, I can't see you. You need to go to a psychiatrist and get on meds." And that was a really interesting thing because I thought, wow, how many people, because I actually wasn't suicidal in a sense of desperate to take my life. I knew that I was going to live, and I knew that I was going to get over this, but I also knew that my feelings of waking up really not wanting to be engaged in my life meant that I needed to get some help. And I thought, how many people actually get that response? You know, how damaging is that?
Oh my God! If you could see me, Keisha, my mouth is, my jaw's on the floor.
Yeah.
Because any of us who do, I've done a lot, a tremendous amount of work around childhood sexual abuse, and you know, it's part of the process. Unfortunately, at least in my experience, that you want to live or die. There's betrayal. There are a lot of complicated factors when you look at that particular issue and the betrayal. You know, and the pain and everything else. So, and also in my experience, many childhood sexual abuse survivors are highly sensitive and cannot tolerate medication. I'm not saying all, but people that I've worked with, medication is not the response. It's working through the stuff. But that's heartbreaking that you were so honest in saying, you didn't say I had a plan, you said, and even if you did have a plan, it's okay, we'll talk about it.
I already knew that the system was broken because this is what I do for a living. But, you know, to be on the other side of it, I just felt so much compassion after I went back and kind of, when I was out of my own little drama, I thought, wow, I wonder, you know, how many people. And you're right, you know, with sexual abuse, what comes up then is you're dealing with it at the age of the person that got abused. So here, I'm 10 years old again. And it was a vice principal in my school, and here's a person in authority that, you know, you're turning it over to someone that's a counselor, you know, you're saying, I really need some help. So you're turning yourself over to someone that you believe will know more than you or can guide you through this. And then when they reject you, it's another betrayal. I thought, whoa, this is really interesting. You know, the logical, rational side of my brain could watch that dynamic unfurl and think, people that don't have the skills already in place, what would this do, you know? So in my work with hypnotherapy and EMDR and brain spotting and some of the things that I've done for trauma release and learned it myself, I realized that 10-year-old little kid was the one that made the decision that she probably didn't belong on the planet, you know, and that's why I got my rheumatoid arthritis later on in life and all the things that were suicidal, but they were socially acceptable forms of suicide. And so, you know, and I got... I I was able to get over that through all this work, and I haven't had rheumatoid arthritis in years. But autoimmunity is you killing yourself. That's what that means.
Yes, energetically speaking, that's the way I understand it. You're attacking yourself.
Well, it's also physically speaking. You're actually attacking yourself. Your immune system is attacking itself.
Yes, absolutely. And you look at it and say, all right, this is a major league thing going on here. What do I need to become aware of or correct?
Right.
And it's not easy, and it's not a blaming the victim thing, because there's so many people out there struggling with whatever, but it is an awareness. If you are open to a holistic approach, not only do you look at the physical, but let's look at the emotional and the energetic,
right,
or the soul, whatever language you want to use. There's so many ways of looking at this. I mean, even suicide with indigenous cultures is seen as, let's bring you into community, right? Let's bring you into community. Mm-hmm. There are stories, I believe it is the Kung tribe in Africa, where if you have done something terrible or shameful, they bring you into the circle, and everyone in the circle tells you of the positive difference you have made in their life. And that is the healing process. And I think you know that I think, Keisha, there are three common elements to suicide that I have discerned. And the first one's pain, and it can be pain of any variety. The second one is disconnection. You know, you may have loved ones, but you don't feel connected. For example, if you saw Bradley Cooper's character in the movie American Sniper, and he's in the bar when he came home, and he calls his wife and says, I'm here. She goes, "Why? What do you mean? Where are you?" And he goes, "I needed a moment." It's when you feel disconnected. And then the third element is ultimate disconnection, which I call disenfranchisement, that where you feel you have no value, worth, or merit, and you are looking at the world as if your nose is pressed to the glass and nothing is keeping you tethered, whether it's a relationship with others, with nature, with whatever name or face you give the divine, whatever it might be. You're totally, totally disconnected, and disconnected from the essence of who you are.
And that's what I think is so important for, I know in my own work with clients in recovery of some of these things, that in my own journey itself was this incredible meditation that happened when I was in India, and I just left my body, and I had this kind of download of information, and the guru that called me over there was dead. I came in my dreams. I went and followed that message. I mean, it was like this very intense mystical experience. Showed up at the ashram, found this cave, went meditating it. 6 hours later, had all this information. And part of what I was shown was my worth. And that was the healing. That means that never in my whole life again will I ever wake up in that state, because of this intense connection to the universe. And that comes in different ways for different people. But what I realized when I came out of that was, oh my goodness, you know, each of us is a light. The way I was shown it is, each of us is a light that makes up this cosmic grid that holds the world together.
Yes.
And if we are not lit up, then that part of that geometry is dark, and it's our responsibility to light up and to really hold that space. So, you know, when we feel these feelings of doubt and worthlessness, you know, in therapy, when you're working with someone, so often that's what we're working with, is helping people to realize their value.
You said it beautifully. I hope to God you've written a book on your life, and I just don't know about it yet, because your story sounds amazing, but you said it beautifully, and I have said it to others as well. You know, we all are light, and it's plugging in and claiming who we are. But sometimes our conditioning, or if you're open to soul contracts or whatever it might be, in coming in, a part of our process is uncovering all the layers of gook and being able to actually see it, much less believe it. But in fact, before I started this conversation with you, I got a text from a client of mine who earlier this week had thought she wanted to drink Drano, and I said that wasn't really a very good idea. And today happens to be her birthday, and we had talked about how she was handling it, and she's very involved in her church community. And It was announced in church or something. And so she just went to me and said, all these people, they're all, you know, they're all going to join her for dinner at a local restaurant. And she's overwhelmed with love. And I'm telling you this, and I've got tears in my eyes because I'm like, thank you, God, you know?
I mean, right.
You know, she got just what she needed, just what she needed today.
That's beautiful. And I think a lot of this is that people that wind up taking their lives have found that they can't find that in some way. They're blocked to it, or they haven't found what they need for their support. And you mentioned you don't like the term commit suicide. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, I don't. I've become a little, I don't know what it is that I went the hall monitor about this. Because people who, you know, I started this book because a colleague of mine took her life by suicide, and then I realized that I, you know, my mother had been, and I worked on hotlines and did all of this, but I you just would say that, but it is considered very insensitive because it's not a crime, at least in the Western world. You know, if you live in Hungary or Singapore, you're going to go to prison if you attempt suicide, and if you're in North Korea, my research tells me relatives of those who died by suicide are penalized, right? And you know, so that different countries respond in different ways. But here, you know, committed suicide makes it sound like it's a crime, and it's not. And you know, it's a sign of many things. It's a social issue. You know, I can even, you know, it's, you know, there are times for some people where suicide is the right answer for them. I'm not saying that it's for everybody. I'm not, but there are times that for people who are making end of life choices, for them it might be the right decision.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that suicide is not an act of cowardice, and
right.
I liked what you wrote about that.
Well, because here's, you know, when Robin Williams died by suicide, right, people came out and said, oh, my God, or not all people. Some people said, hey, this guy's a coward, right? And that made me so mad because it's anything but that. Suicide is indicative of pain. You know, that's what it is. If you and I were in the same room, right, and I were to put a pillow over your face, you're not going to think about it. You're going to fight me, right, so you can catch your breath, right, so you can breathe. That suicide happens for a lot of reasons. It's accumulation of stressors. Cowardice, I do not believe, is one of them. I think pain is the predominant catalyst. And in Robin Williams' case, you know, we've all discovered that there was the autopsy revealed that there were certain proteins due to Parkinson's disease, due to the dementia associated with Parkinson's, which actually was in, you know, found in the autopsy. But you take that and all the other life stressors that led to his decision. I don't see it as cowardice. And even a report that I read that he was not sleeping in the same room as his wife because his anxiety was so severe he couldn't simmer down, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously something was terribly amiss, whether it's neurochemistry, whatever we want to call it, something was wrong, and he made that choice. But I don't see it as cowardice. And if you're driving, a young man told me that he was driving his car and he was going to smash it into an abutment, and he's speeding along a highway late at night, it's empty, and he realizes that he can't do it, right? It was because that instinct for life. But if you have been drinking or drugging, right, your thinking is not going to be normal. You know, if you are full of rage or shame or whatever, I can tell you stories of everybody for every one of those things. It influences you, but it's not cowardice, it's pain.
You talked about some of the cultural risk factors, and one of them was cyberbullying or bullying, and that story that's local here in my community where a girl took her life when she was a victim of cyberbullying. And I've heard that a lot through our stories now in our country, you know, countrywide, that this is on the rise because of cyberbullying. And I think somebody can get taken down and shamed and humiliated so fast with social media today, faster than any time and period of human history. And boy, there are some really serious repercussions for the speed that we can get information out.
I totally agree, and I also think for some kids who feel like it's anonymous, right? I'm sitting on my bed at home. Nobody knows what I am saying, or other kids are saying this, so I can join in. And teenage years are fraught with a lot of back and forth and dealing with your own stuff and figuring out who you are. And if, for example, from a psychological perspective, if you yourself are filled with a lot of self-hate, it might be easier for you to slime somebody because you're just spilling out your own venom. But I totally concur with you that because of this, the rapidity, and then it's up there. It's up there for good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a matter of, oh, oops, I made a mistake. Here's my retraction, because the person has already been slimed. And then you go to school and everybody knows whatever it is that everybody knows. You did X, or they said you did X, or they're compromising pictures, or whatever it is. And it does lead to people feeling like, and especially when you're young. I don't know how the young woman was in your area, but when you're young, you don't often realize there are a lot of chapters in your life. And we're all going to make mistakes or mess up, and that's how we learn, okay. But to live through the public humiliation that is, as you said, so fast, so severe, it's hard to get out from under. And you can see parents saying, it's okay. And you can see their teenager responding, it's not okay. How can I even go to school if they think that way? One young man told me he was bullied so severely during his high school years that when he went to class, he couldn't pay attention to what was going on because he was trying to figure out how to protect himself and get his heart rate to simmer down and just figuring out what was going to happen next. It was all about survival every moment of the day.
Yeah, it is a jungle, that time of life. I am so grateful to be, 50 years old and never have to do that one. It's a jungle, that time of life. I feel so much compassion for people that are going through middle school and high school. It's hard.
It's brutal. I agree with you. It's brutal. And the kids are expected to know so much more, and experientially, they may not, but they may have heard about it. You've got the influence of drugs and alcohol. I had a young woman who was, I guess she was 16, and her parents brought her in because she said she was suicidal. So after everybody talked, I spoke with her there alone. And what the parents told me on the side, oh, Adele, she's not having sex, and I'm thinking, well, I think she is. And that was a big part of what was going on with her, had to do with the way a boyfriend was treating her and how she felt about herself. The idea that there is, the term that I know is domestic violence, but it's that kind of, that teenagers and couple relationships are experiencing that, right? I mean, it's, the world has happened so fast. Kids are exposed to so much. It's hard to keep them grounded. And, you know, people say, well, what should a parent do? And I'm like, first you have to be the parent, not their friend, which is, I want to keep you safe and sane, right?
Yeah, I remember when I lived in Utah, I was a supervisor in a hospital, and a kid came in. There were a lot of botched suicides that wind up in the ICU and in the emergency room, and failed attempts, you know. And this kid was brought in that had drunk a bunch of bleach and smelled like a swimming pool. It was coming out of his pores. And I will never forget this just watching this dynamic when we called his parents in, and I was there to kind of facilitate and be there for this boy and see if we couldn't get a communication happening. And he was just crying. And what he said, he just looked at his mother and said, I just need to know you love me. You know, this was one of those trying to get attention attempts. And And his mom looked straight at him and said, well, if you think this stunt is going to do it, you are just far out, more out to lunch than I thought you were. And I thought, wow, you know, like I wanted to cry just watching this between these parents and this kid. And I thought, I think it's one of the motivating things that took me into learning how to release trauma for people is because parents are not perfect. And they, you know, I've come to this philosophy in life that I actually believe we sign up for the parents we get, and we have a contract that we've said we want to learn when we're here on this planet, and so we kind of set ourselves up for that. We go through our childhood with that perfection of what we said we wanted, you know, to do, and then our adulthood is the time to then unwind it, unpack it, learn it, heal, forgive, and then we move into wisdom stage, and we can teach others about that. And that doesn't always go in a linear fashion. In fact, it rarely does. And so we can get stuck in certain places, right? But I think that's the role of the therapist is to really help, you know, well, what was your contract and how did this perfectly set you up and how, you know, what could we do to facilitate this as a learning experience so that you gain wisdom? And it's an interesting thing to observe what galvanizes certain people and what traumatized certain people, because you know as well as I do that different things will set people off differently, and it's because of those childhood experiences and the meanings we attach to them and then the behaviors that emerge from that. And so I think sometimes when people get stuck with not being able to see that there can be movement through this in the way that I was just describing, then they get to that just deep hopelessness, right? That deep despair. So when we talk about parenting, then, because that was one of my questions, that your wisdom is so amazing in this book about what the advice you offer. What advice do you have for parents? You said don't be their friend. You know, you've got to set boundaries and not enable kids. But what other advice do you have for parents?
Well, I think one of the greatest gifts we can give our kids is developing their EQ or emotional quotient, right? Mm-hmm. And some of that is learning how to be angry. You know, when we're angry, it says, hey, you hurt my feelings. You know, you stepped on my toes or whatever. But learning how to do it in a constructive way where you can do that. Teaching kids, you know, there are wonderful techniques out there, be it heart math, be it yoga, be it meditation, be it shamanism. There are so many different things we can teach our kids on how to be in the world and that the world is a bigger place. But I also think you need to, I have parents who come in and say to me, oh, you know, Del, my kids aren't doing drugs and alcohol, and I want to look at them and go, really? Yes, I'm pretty sure they are. You know, kids are going to experiment with drugs and alcohol and sex. These are not easy things to talk about. And I'll give you an example. I had these parents said, we want you to talk to our kid, but we don't want you to tell our kid that his dad was a major big deal rocker and did a lot of drugs. We don't want our kids to know that. Okay, that was their call because they felt it would influence their kid. And their kid would pull into the driveway of my office, and he had kind of a tall stand-up hair, and the music is bopping, and I was always smiling when he would walk in. And I said to him, okay, so tell me this. If you're at a friend's house over the weekend and you're drunk, can you call your parents and say, come pick me up? He goes, no, I couldn't possibly do that. And I said, that's too bad. The next week, halfway through the session, I hear the outer door of my office open, and then the inner door, there's a knock, and the kid looks at me and says, oh, I forgot to tell you, my mom's coming. I said, okay. So his mom comes in, and she said, did you tell him that? I said, yes, I did. And because I feel that, she said, well, if this happens, he'll be drunk every weekend. I said, if he's drunk every weekend, we're having another conversation. But you don't want your kid behind the wheel. You don't want him to hurt himself. You don't want him to hurt anybody else. If a kid experiments, you want to get them home safely. And I'm not saying you get them home and the next day, you know, you metaphorically beat the stuffing out of them either. But you know, you want to set sensible boundaries, but the bottom line is always their safety. You don't want to minimize their pain. Oh, listen, it's not that bad. No, they're living it now. We're not, right? We want to teach them, as you talked about, life is a process. You know, all right, we're going to mess up. We're going to screw up. All right. but we're going to learn there's another act, there's another possibility. You do have to monitor alcohol and drug use. I had a kid come in, and she was in school, and her water bottle was filled with vodka. I'm like, how the dickens did you get your hands on this much vodka, right? And then the parents decided, because they didn't want her at home, that they were going to let her go with a school trip to Spain. Well, one of the chaperones had to bring her home because she was buying hashish. You know, the kid had some major issues that required a little more activity than the parents wanted to do until it got too late. And you always have to follow the money. Too much discretionary money, it can feed all sorts of addictions with kids, and it's alcohol, drugs, gambling, shopping, whatever it is. And then what we model, and we're not modeling that we're perfect, we're modeling that we're trying the best we can. As much as possible, we want to speak with an open heart, and we want to speak our truth, right? And that I love you, I may not like your behavior, but I always love you. Like that mother in the ER that you witnessed breaks my heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
Breaks my heart. I understand there's a bigger picture of all, but I'm like you, I look at all that, but it breaks my heart. The kids can be secret agents at this age. They can have covert lives that we're really not aware of. And sometimes you have to tease them. I had a teenager whose parents said, you have to go talk to Adele, and the kid didn't want to talk to me. And she would go home and say to her parents, oh, Adele came out in the waiting room, and she was wearing Groucho Marx glasses. And the mother called me and said, were you wearing Groucho Marx glasses? I said, yes, I was trying to do anything. I was. Well, the kids got into a situation, and she called me over holiday weekend and said, I want to see you now. It's 4th of July. And I said, well, sweetie, can't we wait till tomorrow? But teenagers, no. And she was working as a lifeguard, and so she arrives. It's hot and humid Connecticut. It's sticky, sticky, sticky in July. And she's in sweats, sweatpants, sweatshirt, wrapped in a quilt, and carrying the teddy bear her mother gave her when she started therapy with me. And she had an experience of date rape. And because I kept talking to her honestly, and because I also think our kids know, everybody knows, but kids, we don't give kids credit enough, that they know if you're speaking truth. And if you believe in energy, they can read the rest of it. You know, you're going to obviously tell kids age-appropriate stuff. You know, what you say to an 18-year-old is not the same thing you would say to a 5-year-old. But kids know truth, right? And they can recognize it. So this kid told me what happened. We had a conversation. She was in my office till, I don't know, 1:30 in the morning, you know. And, you know, she left my office, and I called her parents, and I said, look, she's on her way home. I can't tell you anything that's going on, but we're okay. All right, so just know she's on her way home. And they said, okay. And then we got everything sorted and everything straightened out that we needed to do. But it was just an example of being persevering. I didn't know what the hell I was doing with a kid who refused to talk to me, you know. There's so many ways that you try to engage. But, you know, somewhere along the line, there was a click. And she felt safe enough to tell me. And she later told her parents, which was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that helped. But we all do the best we can. And if we make a mistake, we say, oops, I really goofed up there.
I think that's key right there, that you are able to say, I'm sorry, here's what I know that I did, here's what I'm going to make sure I don't do again, how can I make mm-hmm. it up to you, and will you please forgive me? I mean,
yes.
Parents just don't realize that is powerful. Teaching your child how to apologize and take responsibility for your goof-up teaches them how to then go forward and do that.
Absolutely, and then to know that you're not expected to be perfect. I had a colleague of mine, a fellow psychologist, happened to send me an email that her husband, another psychologist, sent to their middle school son. And I looked at it, and I wrote to her, and I said, that's the tone of voice he's using with his son, right? It concerns me greatly. I'm thinking the expectation on this poor kid's shoulders. It's too much. We want our kids to do well. We want them to be happy. We want them to succeed. We want them to know that they can get through life and express their feelings. But we're human. We're perfectly human. And this is how we learn.
So one of the things that you talk about in your book is the wisdom of what a survivor has to come back and say. And like I said, I've met a lot of people in my life that have attempted to take their lives and were not successful, either subconsciously or really didn't, you know how to do it properly. And they're like a near-death experience. There's learning that comes out of that, and I'd love for you to share some of that.
There really is. Death as a whole is a fine-tuned focuser of life. Mm-hmm. And one woman in the book, there's stories from the brain, tells the story that she tried several times, and for her, she did therapy, and she's now a minister and a spiritual path, a spiritualist minister, and a spiritual path took her beyond that. You know, one young man tried, and the lifeguard saved him when he was at the beach, and but he was now so grateful, you know, at the time, as 10 years old or whatever it was, he didn't want to say thank you. One woman tells the story. She lost her mom to suicide. Her mom had postpartum. After she had her first child, she had terrible postpartum and, you know, needed to be hospitalized. And after her second child, and all these things, you know, she had the belt around her neck. And she was able to get the help she needed, and she's built an online community of comfort for mothers who go through these extreme states of postpartum, which, by the way, they're doing research now that has indicated that postpartum can often be found to be undiagnosed bipolar. Not in every case, but in some cases there are some similarities of so it's talking about the biochemical and the haywire neurochemistry. But the people who have served, those are people who've been on the brink, and then the family members who've lost someone, they want it to matter. You know, they want it to matter their loved one's life and death. And so one guy in Philadelphia, I call it paying it forward, he talks about it. He's written his own book about it. He wants people to be educated. And he said to me, if I can just save one life, I feel like that would just mean the world to me. I don't want anybody to go through what our family went through. Mm-hmm. A woman who was stationed in someplace in the Middle East, and she was there, and she got a notice that her brother had died, but they hadn't told her it was suicide because it hadn't been determined. And where she was, it was a Muslim area, and she was in a teaching position, and some woman said to her, well, you know, this is the will, and that didn't quite work for her. And she would run. She exercised, had always been away early in the morning, and she would run. And usually she would have two military guys who were running too, who would flank her because she was a female. And so that day she's running, and they're not always the same guys. And she said, hey, fellas, I can tell you want to go faster. And I found out my brother died, and I just can't do it today. And I don't know why every time I tell this story it chokes me up, but these two military guys just slowed down their pace, didn't have to say a word, and got her back to wherever their starting point was safely. Be it exercise, creative expression, making a difference, being an advocate. One woman whose son had been diagnosed with schizophrenia in a senior year in college, she said he had a short but beautiful life, and she's become an advocate for mental health. It changes people in very dramatic ways. One mom I talked to after she lost her son, she herself tried. The gun jammed, the belt broke. She tried because she was going to literally throw herself in the grave after him. But in the meantime, she has been able to become a writer about many things, and has felt her life has been guided by her son from the other side. And it's changed her. It's not the life she thought she was going to have, but it's changed her. Death is a fine-tuned focuser, as I said, and whether you've gotten there and you're on the brink yourself and you survive, there's that story of Buckminster Fuller, you know, the great visionary, and he's, I believe it was Lake Michigan, he was going to take his life. His life was over. And he's walking in, and the water gets higher and higher and higher. And he gets to the point where the water is up to neck or chin level, and he has, I don't know what they want to call it, an epiphany or a revelation or a download, whatever the right words for him. And at that point, he knew how he was going to change his diet, how he was going to live his life, and what he was going to do next. And he turned around and walked out of Lake Michigan a different person.
Mm. A little baptism.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well said.
I've had a couple of patients over the years whose kids have committed suicide, and, you know, it's really, they've come to me because their bodies and minds and spirits are just falling apart, and they don't really realize that it's, you know, when I start digging back to where there could have been a trauma, and this comes up, that it's still relational, you know, like this, if you don't work with this, and you don't acknowledge that if you can get stuck in grief, and if, you know, 10 years after you've lost a child this way, you still are crying about it every time you tell the story, you are stuck in one of those stages of grief. And your body is going to be breaking down around you. And so it's so important that people find the support that they need and get, you know, grief counseling. Do you have good recommendations for people for this?
Well, in the back of my book, I list some. There are, for people who lose children, there's a group, they're international, called the Compassionate Friends, and they are out there. There's another group, and I'm going to look up the name as I'm talking to you. That particular group is not open to the spiritual element, and there are people like myself who find the spiritual element very helpful, and so there is another group out there, and I hope I will get the name for it. But there are many people who have written books. Julia Cook has written a lot of. She's done National Center for Youth Issues and the CDC, and she's written children's books that are great for parents. And the Newtown shooting, I had written a piece on that and recommended one of her books, and after that she wrote another book on disaster. There are many. Oh, it's Helping Parents Heal. There's that group. There's, in your community, if you look, there usually you will find places that offer support, and there are many people out there who are happy to do one-to-one work, or there's group work. Sometimes churches, and not in a denominational way, but will provide space for various support groups where you can get some help just to look through this and to deal with it. There, in my experience, I have not found a tremendous amount of groups for people who've lost loved ones to suicide, except if you're a military family. If you're a military family, there are a number of groups available. And there's some online resources as well. I was working with one family, and just given logistics and children and this and that, we went online and we found some resources online where you could participate online. And for some people, that might even be safer. I know one mom who lost her son in California, and she got support online. And she, you know, she wasn't somebody who was necessarily tech-savvy, but she learned what she needed to do so that she could go online and have some conversations, and she found tremendous support that way. There is a lot out there. If you just begin to scratch the surface, there will be a lot. And in some communities, you have clearinghouse kind of numbers where they can direct you to specific things as well.
For our listeners that are just joining us, I am talking to Dr. Adele Ryan McDowell, who is the author of Making Peace with Suicide, and we're having a very wonderful conversation about this. The back of the book has a lot of great resource material in the appendix. And one of the things that you talk about in your book is the energy of suicide and suicide as the death of the ego.
Yes, I do.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Oh, good. You're so terrific. I love this. Okay. All right. So there's two ways to look at it, right? There is the you know, we all have multiple deaths of the ego when we go through various life things, right? You mentioned some of yours. I've had mine. And the old part of us goes and the new part of us takes over, right? For the energy of suicide on the planet just speaks to the soulless lives that many of us lead, right? I think that feeds the energy of a half-dead, parasuicidal life, because we're not really living life. We're not being the light. We haven't turned on our sparkle. right? We're not enjoying. We're racing, as we said earlier, time to make the donuts. So it's that piece. But I also believe that there are many people, for those who are open to the more metaphysical and energetic explanation, who have raised their hands to go out at this time to be of service on the other side. And yeah, I started this book when a friend of mine that I knew from a healing conference, I got a phone call. She's on the West Coast. And they said, hey, did you know that Susan had died? And I'm like, what are you talking about? She just had her 65th birthday. I had just sent her an email. What are you talking about? And it turns out that she'd been hospitalized, and I knew that she had had some mental health issues when she was in graduate school. She was a clinical psychologist, and I think that her very own vulnerabilities made her an excellent therapist. She went, but while I was doing the book, you know, I had experience where I could look out the window and all the leaves on the bush would turn into faces. All the tiles in the bathroom would turn into faces. The carpet would turn into faces. I've recently been having more face experiences in the middle of the night of people trying to come through and me deciding how I'm going to handle this next set of, I think there are people who died by suicide. So what I found out from Susan was that it was her time. She said, I didn't have the energy of cancer. I didn't want to do chance car accident and hurt someone else. And this was right, and I'm busier than ever, and I'm doing work from the other side. Many cultures are open to the idea that you know, death is basically another shapeshift into another level of consciousness and being. It is not, it's not the final curtain. It's not the end, right? There is communication or symbols available from loved ones from the other side. In this particular instance with Susan, you know, she's one of those raised hands, and her death of the ego was a very final physical death, and for her to go on and do other work. Some people may find some satisfaction in that. Some people, it may not resonate with them, but I do believe that there is life after death, and I do believe that our planet with the busyness and not time to smell the roses and to be, and how that you know, it weakens our relationships with one another. That's what feeds us. We're human beings. We're social animals. When we have a good conversation with somebody, it can just feed you for days. Or if you read a great book, or you hear a great piece of music, or you have a walk in the park and there's that patch of sunlight that just stops you, or your dog is goofy and makes you laugh. We don't have time for all of these things because we're racing around. And we also live in a world that is very, very fear-driven. And if we're able to, you know, work with our fears and get a more expanded perspective and, you know, ground ourselves and understand that we are the channel between heaven and earth, right? That's us. We're that channel.
Adele, we're at the end of the show, and I want to make sure that a couple of things get said. One of them, you have a really nice place in the book about if a loved one is feeling suicidal, to make sure to establish safety, to have compassion, to listen to their pain, and to make sure that you stop the momentum if you can. But I think also, you know, there are hotlines, like you mentioned, for being able to call in and get professional help. I know teenagers will tell each other, and I've had teens come to me and ask what to do if this happens. So making sure that hand it over to an adult that can then go through the proper channels. And this conversation, of course, has only scratched the surface, so I want to make sure that our listeners know how to find you. Can you give your URL?
Sure. It's AdeleRyanMcDowell.com, or there's one on the book, MakingPeaceWithSuicide.com. And for a little more expanded view of the universe, there's another blog, AdeleAndThePenguin.com.
Oh, nice. Okay, I'll have to look at that one. All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today about this subject that needs to be talked about more, and I really appreciate you taking time and the work that you've done in the universe here putting this out.
Oh, thank you, Keisha. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm very grateful, and you're a total delight.
Oh, and fight back at you. Remember, everyone, to live, love, laugh, learn, and listen to the Healthy You Radio Network, and have a fantastic day.
Food is medicine. A change to a diet that is suited to your body type, genes, and unique body needs can help with all health issues. Food as medicine can cure up to 75% of health issues and at least make a difference in 100% of health issues. Our nutritionist will spend at least an hour working with you to integrate healthy food choices into your unique life and work schedule. Erin is compassionate and listens to your food concerns, giving you recipes and meal plans that will fit into your life. Call 425-391-3376 today to make an appointment with Erin and take charge of your health.